Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui, sitting in for host Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, a man incarcerated at Avenal State Prison talks about what it's like living behind bars during a pandemic. And documentary filmmakers show us inside the Mesa Verde Detention Center. But first, we're going to take you to a produce buyback event for small farmers put on by the Asian Business Institute and Resource Center in Fresno. It's called a buyback because the institute purchases some of the fruits and vegetables growers aren't able to sell due to markets being disrupted by COVID-19 and gives the produce back to communities facing food insecurity. FM 89's news director Alice Daniel has this story.
Outside the Fellowship Missionary Baptist Church on Belmont Avenue in downtown Fresno, volunteers unload boxes of ribbed cinqua, a long green Southeast Asian vegetable, from a pickup truck.
All right, they're all good to go.
They're all good to go. All of it?
About 35 micro-farmers signed up for today's buyback, including Warren Derbeedy. He brought 15 boxes of crops he can't sell otherwise.
Today I bring some chili abrol, some dry chilies, and some mustard, and some eggplants.
He used to be a truck driver, but he says there are too many rules and regulations. So a couple years ago, he started farming on about 8.5 acres. It's something he learned growing up in India. It was a good decision, he says, but he never expected a pandemic.
You know, it's really hard these days because before we used to sell vegetables in the market, in the stores, and in the temples.
Temples and some farm markets are closed, he says, and even grocery stores are buying less. Farmer Antonio Olmo says he's seeing the same thing and estimates he's lost about 30% of his crops in the last few months.
Buyers are not buying, grocery stores, restaurants are not buying as much. So a lot of it is sitting in the packing sheds and it's going bad in the sheds. And therefore, we at the end of the day, we end up losing.
Losing because packing houses are backed up and aren't buying as much of his produce. So Olmos hauled 76 boxes of butternut squash here.
And that's probably maybe 2% of what I have out there that I got nowhere to take it.
He says he's not even picking some of his crops because the market is so bad. And that means some are left to rot. But today was a win. He was paid about $1,200 for his squash.
It is a big help, especially when there's products that are perfectly good. They're tasteful, but stuff like that we have to throw away.
The need is huge, especially because they're not receiving funds from any place else, and some of the other funding that's been released still targets industrial-sized farming.
That's Carmen Mendoza. She's the deputy director of the Asian Business Institute and Resource Center, and she's running the buyback. Funding was provided from the CARES Act through the city of Fresno, and help has materialized in other ways.
Well, today we are super blessed. Normally we have about 40 to 60 volunteers for the entire day. I think we're topping at about 90 today.
Volunteers to unload those boxes farmers bring in, but also to pack about 2,000 grocery bags of produce to help feed the community. Churches, food pantries, and other groups like Lao Veterans and the Fresno American Indian Health Project we'll pick up the bags later in the day and distribute them.
It's a lot of fun, a lot of great work that we're doing.
Santiago Rodriguez is Mendoza's son. He studies computer science at Harvey Mudd College. But today, his volunteer role is efficiency manager. As he walks into a large room with open doors, he yells out.
All right, guys, make sure to keep up your social distancing, all right?
Boxes of vegetables are piled high on the floor in two rows.
Right now we have two lines. One is mainstream crops and one is Southeast Asian crops.
15-year-old Autumn Chang says she's here because it's a good use of her time.
I just want to help out the community since we're in quarantine and we have nothing to do.
She grabs a plastic bag and heads down the mainstream crop line.
I'm just getting some... what is this called?
Volunteer Emily Harrington hands her some very large beets, almost the size of cantaloupes. Harrington is in high school and says she's happy to be helping out, even if the room is, not surprisingly on this Fresno summer day, hot.
It's better to be uncomfortable and help others than be comfortable and have others struggling out there.
Blong Zhang, the executive director of the institute, takes apart boxes that have been emptied and sets them outside. He points to a table showcasing some of the crops that have been brought in. Summer squash, cherry tomatoes, moringa leaves, dinosaur gourds, long beans, and bitter melon.
As you can see, all the different crops that are coming through. If we weren't doing this, it's probably going to go to waste.
Instead, he says, small farmers are getting a break during the pandemic and providing fresh, free food to people in need. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. The biggest outbreaks of COVID-19 in the country right now are inside correctional facilities, and near the top of that list is Avenel State Prison in Kings County, which has the second highest case count of any state prison in California. What is it like to be inside the prison right now, grappling with more restrictions on an already confined life? FM 89 health reporter Carrie Klein spoke with Jacob Benitez, who's been incarcerated at Avenel since 2019.
So, Jacob Benitez, you're serving a sentence of 26 years for a series of robberies and for being in possession of a firearm. You've been in prison for almost a decade and at Avenel itself for a little over a year. So, tell me, what was the mood like when COVID-19 cases began spiking in May and June? You know, what had changed from your experience before?
Yeah, I've been involved in the Inmate Advisory Council. And basically what we do is we try to keep the inmate population at the facility abreast on all the information that's being trickled down from administration. And the COVID-19 conversation started in March. And since March 1st, there's been tremendous changes in the programming that we have here. So every function of the prison has taken a toll. And whether it be in morale, a lot of the guys here have taken a lot of shots at their morale and their hope. Major bed movements, there was a lot of mass amount of testing going on, and we've had a lot of battles trying to gain information with what's going to happen next as far as this whole COVID-19 and how the prison's going to be affected. So that's basically where we're at now. It's just a constant change of the information that's being put out there, so we're constantly just working hand in hand with administration to facilitate that information to the inmates and our families as well.
And has it been scary at all, you know, not kind of knowing where, you know, who could get the disease, who will get it, what that will be like?
Actually, especially in the beginning, I'm sure just the way it was very traumatic out there for you guys, once we started getting wind of this, you can tell that the energy changed. A lot of the people started fearing, especially people who had like the valley fever out here, people who already have respiratory issues, a lot of older people, they were starting to think, every time we talked about it, they started to think twice about being here. And you could see a lot of guys, you know, start to really want to take care of themselves. A lot of guys started working out. A lot of guys started trying to eat better. Yeah, it's been a real I don't want to say a mind game, but it's been a crazy experience dealing with this so far.
Yeah, and tell me about what's changed for you on an everyday basis. Like, you know, are you required to wear masks at certain times? Are there social distancing requirements? You know, like what's changed for you in that way?
Well, we are actually being required to wear the masks majority of the time. When we're outside on the yard, we can, you know, basically, you won't have to wear the mask as much, except when interacting with the staff. The social distance thing, it doesn't exist here. It doesn't. There's no way possible to social distance in a multi-faucet shower, you got restrooms next to each other. You can't social distance from your bunkie. You know, the guy that you basically share a bunk with, if you're on the bottom bunk, he's about 3 feet away from you on the top bunk. So, yeah, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, and are you wearing a mask right now?
I have to wear a mask in the day room. Yes, I do.
All right. And so in early June, if we go back a couple months, early June, you know, an advocacy group, Fuel, they staged a car caravan, a protest outside of the prison, and they got you to call one of the organizers, and you got amplified, like, on a megaphone during the protest. What made you want to speak out at that time?
There was a mass amount of people, including our supporters, which consist of our families and friends, who was seeking a voice, and I can notice that the demographic in prison, it's hard for them to speak up. It's very difficult. And I felt this need to just speak on behalf of my brothers and sisters who are incarcerated, as well as the mothers, the uncles, I wanted to affirm all the family members of inmates that, you know, we're staying hopeful, that we're staying strong, and that we appreciate them. We appreciate people like you hearing our voice. And the moment I was about to speak over the phone, a buddy of mine, he sat next to me, and I was waiting to speak, and he put his phone next to my ear, and I heard little kids and women screaming, "Let them go. Let them go." And they were yelling this over and over. And when I heard that, I heard family members who were missing their fathers, their husbands, their sons, nephews. I heard all of this, and I felt that it was only right for them to at least get a response.
So that protest was almost 2 months ago now. You know, how has life at Avenal changed since then?
Well, that was before they actually started letting massive amounts of people go home. So now the a lot of the short-term gentlemen who are serving, you know, very short sentences are being let home. So I could see the response to not only that protest, but multiple others that were held on behalf of people in prison in regards to COVID-19. It's eye-opening, you know, just seeing the guys leave home that you wouldn't think that, man, wow, you got this much time and now you're going home, you just for being behaving and now you're going. So it really worked out for a lot of gentlemen. There is an effect on a lot of the long-term offenders, though, because there's a statistic that people who have short-term offenses are more likely to come back. And, you know, it's kind of, it is disappointing for us a little bit. I mean, we're happy for men that are able to go home. It's just you can see a lot of the demographic of long-term offenders were like, wow, man, when's our time, you know? We're waiting for our chance. And a lot of us understands what it takes now to go home and stay home and be productive citizens of society.
Well, so if we talk about COVID-19, you know, so you've told me that no one from your yard has gotten sick. You've tested negative. But, you know, have you heard anything about what the disease is like for those who do test positive and what the experience is like to have to go to a hospital?
No, we've been trying to figure out what it's like. The last time I heard of anything was when a CO was telling me that he was going to, they have a mini hospital right here called OHU. And when he went over there, he basically said that he seen guys on respirators, and it was a scary look. It was a scary look, and that initially a lot of everybody thought COVID-19 wasn't that serious until it hit. And now people I mean, we've had, what, 4 deaths at this prison, and massive amount of people asymptomatic, but there was also people that did get sick and got over it. So, it's been a lot of people affected by it here.
Yeah. And actually, as of when we're recording this, there have been 5 deaths from COVID-19 at Avenal so far.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. And so, so I know you're married, but visitations have been postponed indefinitely by the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. So how do you and other inmates there, how do you stay in touch with loved ones throughout this time?
The only way we can stay in touch with loved ones right now is through this state phone that we're speaking on now and through letters. That's it. And it's real tough. It's real tough. Just last night I was talking to my wife and she told me that she forgot my face. She forgot what I looked like in person. And it's real sad, you know. And I told her, you know, I almost feel the same. I can remember just a few things, but it does put a strain on your relationship, and you do the best you can with the means that you have.
That's heartbreaking. That sounds really hard.
It is.
Well, so Jake, we've talked a handful of times, you know, before this conversation. You're always so upbeat. How do you stay so positive throughout all this?
First and foremost, that's my faith. It's my God. I love my God. He pulls us through so many different obstacles, and he's really changed my life. You know, first thing I wake up in the morning, I go brush my teeth, and I'm talking to God already. I'm just asking him to give me the strength to carry through the day, the energy, the spirit, to have my brothers next to me, have my family, and just help out those next to me, because we all need it. And that's what I look forward to every day. It's just trying to inspire people to do something different with their life and receive that spirit so that they can find personal growth and meaning where they are right now. So, and plus the family, I love my wife, my mother. I got friends, real supportive, and I'm doing it for them too. And there's a lot of guys like me. There's a lot of guys like me in here that are doing the same. They're contributing, they're giving back right here where they are. And I feed off of them, they feed off of me. We try to make the best of what we have right now. We're very limited on what we have, but fortunately, we're able to run support groups in here, and that really helps out the energy in the room. It brings guys that peace, like, okay, you know, at least there's not, I mean, other prisons, I'm pretty sure, are worse than our prison. And in regards to them not having anything to do, and you have nothing to do, and you can't work on yourself as a human being while incarcerated, you tend to go with what you know. So for the most part, we've been blessed with the opportunity to stay busy in here. And whether it be recreational or rehabilitative, a lot of guys figured out a way to stay busy and stay productive. And talking to people like you, talking to people that are out there sharing our story. And we feel heard. We know we're heard, and that gives us the energy to carry out our task daily. So that's our motivation. That's what inspires us the most.
That's fantastic. Well, Jacob Benitez, thank you so much for talking with me today, and I wish you all the best there at Avenal.
Thank you so much for your time, and God bless you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Avenal State Prison isn't the only local correctional facility grappling with COVID-19. Back with us to talk more about outbreaks in prisons and jails and to explain Governor Gavin Newsom's recent shift in focus to the San Joaquin Valley is FM89 health reporter Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID update. Thanks for being here, Carrie.
Hi, thanks, Laura.
So what's happened in the last week when it comes to COVID-19?
Well, a lot has happened, unfortunately, and not much of it is good. That's kind of the theme that we're going with now week by week here. So we're now up to 50,000 cases in the 7 counties in our coverage area. That's close to 2%. We're creeping up on that 2% mark. And around 70 people have died just in the last week. That's our biggest weekly tally yet, unfortunately. And so we're getting some very focused attention from the state, as you alluded to in the intro here. And that's saying something, since California as a state has hit some records for case counts and for deaths recently as well. And so according to Governor Newsom's order earlier in the week, 8 counties in the San Joaquin Valley are set to receive $52 million to bolster testing, contact tracing, and quarantine efforts. And the governor is also sending 3 unified support teams, what some people are calling strike teams, and those will be working alongside public health and emergency officials to help wherever they're needed, like strategizing what's needed on the ground, how to increase capacity at hospitals, things like that. And as of earlier this week, county health officials did not have a lot of details about what the work with those teams would look like, but that will emerge over the coming weeks, I'm sure. Also in big news this week, there was a study of farm workers that was released this week from the California Institute for Rural Studies, and it shows that COVID-19 is 3 times more prevalent among agricultural workers than among non-ag workers. And the study also surveyed around 900 farm workers and found that many of them are not receiving the face masks as promised. Many of them continue to work in large cohorts that aren't being socially distanced. And there are a lot of other very unfortunate factors that continue to exacerbate the inequities between farm worker populations, which are primarily Latino, and the other demographic groups in different industry sectors here in this area.
Wow. And I understand you have some notable highlights from a few counties in our area. Tell us about those.
Right. So to just go through a couple counties here. So in Fresno, we've seen a continued rise in COVID-19 cases in the Fresno County Jail. I'll go into more detail about that later in this interview. In Tulare County, on Wednesday, the American Civil Liberties Union just sued the county jail there, alleging that the sheriff's office has not done enough to prevent COVID-19 transmission there and has even gone so far as to deny masks to inmates and not systematically test inmates for the disease, despite a request from a county judge to do so. Again, that's what's alleged in this lawsuit. But so far in the Tulare County Jail, the case count is 22 inmates and 5 employees so far that have tested positive. So that story is still developing as that lawsuit progresses. In Kern County, there are a lot of new things that have been approved by the Board of Supervisors, including millions of dollars to bring in 80 new ICU nurses that'll help out with a lot of hospitals in the county. They're also bringing in tons of personal protective equipment, this PPE for small businesses, things like hand sanitizer, masks. They've also opened up a new high capacity testing site aiming to test 5,000 people a day for the next 2 weeks. So that'll be huge. In Mariposa County, that's usually where the best news is in our area. They do still have the lowest case rate in our coverage area. However, they did report a second death this week of COVID-19, but still only 2 deaths since March. So that's still pretty good.
And so let's turn back to the Fresno County Jail. We first reported cases there a few weeks ago. Can you give an update on what the outbreak there looks like now?
Right. Well, unfortunately, that case count just keeps rising as more people get tested. So as of earlier this week, Sheriff Margaret Mims confirmed for me that there have been 910 inmates who have tested positive and around 60 employees. Still 400 are awaiting test results, and also around 400 are still under quarantine. The rest of them have recovered or have been released.
Wow, that sounds huge. I mean, give us some context. Is that a lot of people relatively?
Yes, that is a lot of people. It's more than 40% of all the inmates housed there. So that's almost half. So, you know, that's pretty tremendous. And the New York Times has been tabulating data in what they call clusters in facilities like prisons, jails, nursing homes, army bases, businesses. And according to New York Times data, this from around the country, this number would actually put the Fresno County jail outbreak among the top 20 clusters in the country. And the ACLU has sued county jails with far fewer cases, with less than 100 cases. It is tough to know, however, if there are other county jails with outbreaks this big around California, and that's because there has not been a lot of data, and that's because the state does not centralize the data the way that they do for state prisons or skilled nursing facilities. Mm-hmm. However, today is the first day that the state is actually launching a new data dashboard for county jails, and so that will reveal a lot more information there.
Okay. And what is the Fresno County Sheriff's Office doing to contain the outbreak at the jail?
Well, so they've told me that they've, you know, one thing they've done is set up a tiered quarantine system, kind of, you know, they call them red, orange, yellow, and green. Green is if you've tested negative, you're clear. Red is if you've tested positive, and there are various stages in between for if you have symptoms or not. They also have a goal to test everyone weekly, particularly those who've tested negative, to keep making sure that they haven't been exposed to the disease. They've also dropped the prison or the jail population by 900 people. That's a little more than a third since March. And that's partly because of a $0 bail policy enacted at the state level earlier in the year. As a side note, though, MIMS does say that that's caused other problems. So that there have been actually a lot of repeat offenders because they've been sent home instead of being put in jail initially.
Wow. And just before this interview, we heard you speaking with a man who is currently incarcerated at Avenal State Prison. There have been a lot of fluctuations in cases there over the last few months. Can you give us an update on what's been happening there in Avenal?
Yeah, so right now the cumulative total is about just over 1,200 cases among inmates and 93 among staff. For a while, there were very few new cases at Avenal. It looked like the outbreak had been contained, but in the last week, there have been more than 200 new cases again. So that cumulative total is ticking back up again. There have also been 5 deaths, unfortunately, in total, and it is still the state prison in California with the second highest cumulative total behind San Quentin.
And the agency in charge of state prisons, we know as the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. So what is the CDCR doing about the outbreak at Avenal?
Well, so they turned down an interview request from me, but they did answer some questions by email. They have tested almost all the inmates at the prison. They're testing employees every 14 days and then doing, you know, symptom screening at the door. And they're using a lot of different places on campus, at the site of the prison to quarantine inmates depending on their testing status. And so this is the way that, and they've also ended visitations. And so these are some of the ways that they're really trying to contain this outbreak, and we'll see really in the long term if it's working.
Yeah, I guess even with all of those mitigation tactics, I mean, why are correctional facilities such a hotbed for this disease?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And they really are. I mean, most of the biggest outbreaks in the country with hundreds and hundreds of cases are in correctional facilities. So yes, to answer this question, to learn a little bit more about why, I spoke with Don Spector. He's an attorney and executive director of the Prison Law Office in San Quentin.
They're congregate living environments where people are housed very close together without any space. And in addition, in California, prisons especially, you have lots of older people and people with various illnesses or conditions which make them more vulnerable to COVID than normal because of their age as well. And so the combination of those two factors suggested that it was a disaster waiting to happen, and that eventually came true, unfortunately and tragically.
And so his organization is involved in litigation against the state government due to overcrowding in prisons and failure to provide mental health care and disability accommodations throughout the pandemic.
Wow. And we should know, I mean, it's not just the incarcerated population or the employees at prisons who are at risk for the disease, right?
That's right. It's also the community around them. I mean, employees bring the disease out with them, and so do people when they're released. And I talked about this specifically with Lucia Tian. She's a chief analytics officer with the American Civil Liberties Union based in New York, and she focuses specifically on county jails. She echoed a lot of what Don Spector said, but there are some differences that really concern her.
Jails are particularly bad because they are sort of the revolving doors of incarceration. So we face 10.7 million admissions a year. That is huge. That's an admission every 3 seconds in America. And the average stay is just 25 days. And so that means that jails are places where people are really crowded, and they don't have these sort of protections of social distancing and sort of other health measures. And then people cycle in and out.
And so what can be done to protect these populations and the communities, you know, people who live around them?
Well, Tian and Spector both talked about overcrowding. I mean, that one of the biggest priorities should be to reduce prison populations, and that could include, you know, letting go of people who are within a few months of the ends of their sentences, or it could involve like pushing up probation hearings that were set to happen later this year. Or in county jails, for instance, you know, the state did set a $0 bond earlier this year that would keep people out of jail if they're just currently waiting to pay their bail. You know, and these lawyers also advocate for some different practices of, you know, arresting and policing to keep people out of jails and prisons in the first place if they're not, you know, really violent offenders. And then, of course, they also advocate for a lot of the same public health measures that we're seeing outside of prison walls, you know, regular testing, perhaps surveillance testing, you know, doing that now rather than waiting for an outbreak, plus really effectively social distancing and allowing for personal protective equipment within prison walls. You know, they think just doing all of these things better would really help to contain the outbreaks and prevent them.
Okay, thank you so much for this update, Carrie.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. A new documentary from Define American highlights unsafe living conditions at Mesa Verde, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement processing facility in Bakersfield, during the pandemic. FM89's Madi Bolaños spoke with the director, Shauna Sigelko, digital producer, William Johnston Carter, and a recently released detainee, Charles Joseph.
Thank you all so much for joining us on Valley Edition. Shauna, I want to start with you.
Great. Hi. I'm so happy to be here.
Great to have you. So why did you choose Mesa Verde for the documentary?
Yeah, so at Define American, we were in the middle of doing a video series around immigrant heroes in the age of COVID. And I came across this story. We actually, the Detention Watch Network, I got an email from the Detention Watch Network, and they were launching a campaign called Freedom, hashtag Freedom All. And that's how I first learned about the story. And I immediately assumed it was going to be a huge national story. I started doing some research, and I was really surprised to see that there wasn't more coverage. So I just reached out to one of the legal firms mentioned in one of the stories, and those lawyers were actually representing the detainees at Mesa Verde. So that's how we initially got connected.
Will, how did it go as far as access to getting videos inside the detention center?
It was pretty difficult. I mean, luckily the prisoner, the detainees have the ability to make video calls. We have to use this proprietary prison software, which is pretty difficult to use and actually like pretty expensive. It can be $12 an hour to talk to someone in detention, which is basically minimum wage in California, which is kind of insane. And for many of the detainees, this is the only way they have to see their families or talk to their loved ones. So luckily I was able to use the prison software and funds from Define American to talk to folks, and the law firms were able to put us in contact with people.
And in terms of collaboration with the prison itself, was it difficult to get that permission?
I mean, so we, like, you know, ICE obviously, I mean, like, ICE doesn't really allow cameras into the detention center. So it's sort of a process of talking to the detainees via video call and then hunting around online looking for photos. Luckily, there's this really incredible local organizing group in Bakersfield called the Kern Youth Abolitionists, who have taken some really, have taken photos, drone photography of the facility, and they were kind enough to share some of their photos with us. And then there's the process of finding other photos that already existed online.
Right. And so finding Charles, were you hesitant to be in the documentary, or what was that thought process for you?
It's risky. You know, of course, it's I was a little hesitant because, you know, I got to think of retaliation and the negative effects on my immigration case, which is still ongoing, actually, and how ICE could retaliate on me. So, yeah, there was definitely a hesitation.
And ultimately, what made you decide to join the documentary?
It's the cause. It's what's happening, you know. If I don't shine light on it, who will? If I don't step up and speak out, who will? I mean, it's been going on for too long. You know, this is not a new thing. This thing has been happening for a while, for years now. And COVID-19 has just magnified it, has just showed all the flaws that exist, you know. And so I was, I felt it was my duty. I had to. Yeah.
And what was it like organizing inside the detention center?
Initially, there's a lot of roadblocks in there, you know, trying to organize. I mean, there's guys from all over the world, you know, different countries, different languages and so forth. So there was a whole list of barriers that I faced. And once I seen that and I could try and troubleshoot around it, I realized that we all share a common, there's a common factor, and that's we are all in oppression. We are all, you know, downpressed by this system that we're in. And so that became the key. That became the key. And I started with creating a list of all those medically vulnerable, you know. And once I included those people and they understood what I was standing for, I had to figure out a way to include those who didn't fall under this medical category. And so I wrote the letter, which actually turned into a video that's online that's titled Detention into Death Sentence. So, yeah, once the guys were, you know, I got the guys to read this letter and be a part of this, and they all signed it. It's a 100-man dorm. Then they kind of got on the same page. Then I could talk to guys individually and in little groups of five, maybe up to 10, and kind of broaden this thinking of what our next steps can become, you know, what we have to do, how we can do this, and so forth. So it was definitely a challenge, you know, but
And I understand that you brought that letter and the list of concerns to ICE officials. How did that conversation go?
Oh man, it's, you know, I started with just the guards, so conversations with the guards and just letting them know so they can tell their superiors. And that was going nowhere, because then they just came back like, look, man, you guys are safer in here. You guys are safer in here. That's all they kept saying. So I talked to their superiors. And even they sent me to higher. Some of them would sympathize and be like, look, well, we understand, and you're making valid points, but this is ICE. ICE makes procedures and everything, you know, for how the facility runs. It comes from ICE. So then I talked to ICE, and ICE, they didn't care. You know, they just listened. Actually, ICE agent would come into the dorm, and I would actually speak to him in person. And he was like, okay, just write it down, fill it out, and send it. Send a request. So I would send a request, and it fell on heartless ears. You know, they really don't care.
Can you describe some of the conditions at the detention center during this pandemic?
Man, in the height of the pandemic, there's guards walking around with no gloves, no face masks, and they go in and out of the facility whenever, you know, freely. They move freely. And not just that, they search our bunk area. They pat us down, you know, and they don't wear gloves. So it's just this contamination that's happening. And not just that, I'm in a 100-man dorm. So it's one room with 100 bunks, double stacked, and there's no space. It's less than 3 feet apart from each bunk. Facilities are just dirty. Bathrooms, I was there for 11 months. And at no point did I ever see a janitor, a custodian, come in and clean the restroom areas or the living areas or any of that, you know. Soaps. There are no soap dispenser, no towel, paper towel dispensers. The way the water comes out, it's a push system. You have to continuously push every 2 seconds. There's like 5 bars of soap when I was there. 5 bars of soap in the bathroom where 100 guys have to share. 5 bars of soap. I mean, that's the most simplest thing they say is wash your hands, you know, regularly. And there's 5 bars of soap for 100 guys. That was crazy.
Yeah. Thank you, Charles. I want to go back to the documentary. Shauna, what do you hope people will gain from watching this documentary, and who do you hope sees it?
Yeah, well, I mean, just listening to Charles just now, is such a reminder for why we felt this was such an urgent story to tell. Our hope is that we raise awareness about what's happening and about the urgency of these detention centers, because lives are at stake. And it's all in the hashtag free them all. We want to see everyone who's unnecessarily detained let go immediately. We know what's happening. We know the risks. And it's unconscionable to keep people in detention who have their lives at stake. And the people we hope who see it are the same people who were outraged about the child separation at the border a few years ago. And that's a general audience. You know, a lot of Americans, regardless of their views on immigration, felt that families should not be separated. And I'm sure that if there was more awareness about what's happening in detention centers right now, there would be the same uproar.
I understand documentaries tend to take a longer time to make, but this one seems like it was produced fairly quickly. William, can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, with something like this, time is definitely of the essence. I mean, the situation in ICE detention with coronavirus is getting progressively more and more worse. So at Mesa Verde in Bakersfield, at the end of June, an employee tested positive for COVID. In early July, detainees started testing positive. Basically, everyone in the facility, there's no legal need for them to be in the facility. To the extent that people have like committed a crime, they've already served their prison sentence and have been deemed parolable by the correctional, you know, federal prison system. So everyone in Mesa Verde could be released tomorrow if ICE were to allow them to do that. So I mean, the benefit of quarantine is that I'm working from home. I can basically put as much time as possible into a project like this. So it's just sort of working on the film every day, you know, all day, every day for 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, there's definitely things, if there had been more time, like it would have been great. There's things that could have been included in the film, and, you know, I would have loved to make a feature film, like video about what was happening, but we felt it was important to get it out as quickly as possible.
Right. And so what were some of those challenges in producing the film?
I mean, definitely getting in contact with folks in Mesa Verde, trying to find material to show, like trying to find photos of the detention center to convey to the viewer what it looks like inside the detention center. But it's also, there's just a lot to the story. So trying to make sure it's factually accurate and that we're giving a complete picture to a viewer who, like, you know, hasn't heard the story before.
And I understand that there were multiple people inside of the documentary that also spoke besides Charles.
Yeah,
how were
so
you
we
able
spoke
to connect with
them? Susan Betty, who's a lawyer at Central Legal, which is a nonprofit in San Francisco that's helping folks in detention fight their law case. We talked with Charles, who is currently at home, but was formerly in the detention center. And we talked with a man named Asif, who's currently in detention. If there had been more time, it would have been great to talk to more folks. But unfortunately, you know, we're sort of strapped for time.
Well, I want to thank you again all so much for joining me for this panel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maddie.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Over the past few months, we've talked to a number of doctors and nurses about their experiences during the pandemic. Today, we'll hear from Dr. Amy Mehta. She's a pulmonary critical care physician at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital. FM89's news director, Alice Daniel, spoke with her earlier this week.
Welcome to Valley Edition, Dr. Mehta. I'd like to start by asking you to describe what your days are like right now at Memorial, beginning with the precautions you take going into work to the patients you're seeing.
With COVID, you know, obviously there's more precautions that we need to take. So when I go into the hospital in the morning, just for my own protection and for my family at home, I, you know, change my clothes once I get there when I'm going to see the COVID patients. And we have to put a gown on, an N95 mask, a face shield, head covering, and also shoe coverings before we enter the rooms, and help take care of some of the ICU patients there that have COVID-19. So I go from room to room, and then we take everything off. When I get home, I go straight to the shower, and I take a shower, and then I say hi to my family members. I have two little kids at home, and so they know that they're not supposed to hug me or touch me or, you know, have any contact with me until I have come out of the shower. And then, of course, they're very happy and greeting me with hugs. But that's my daily, that seems to be what I do every day.
So it sounds like it's become very ritualized for you.
It has. It's just become a daily thing. Don't even really think about it too much anymore. It's just something I do every day.
And so tell me about the patient's experiences. What are you seeing in the ICU and in on the other floors where you're working?
So I primarily see the patients in the ICU that are on the ventilator or that are requiring high amounts of oxygen. And, you know, these patients, they are usually in the hospital for days, if not weeks, you know, requiring high amounts of oxygen, especially the ones that end up on the ventilator. You know, they are in their room by themselves. Even the ones on, actually all the COVID-19 patients are in rooms by themselves. They have contact with us, with the staff, but no visitors are allowed at the hospital right now. They are allowed to, you know, we have FaceTime, so they can talk to their family through FaceTime, but some of these patients are very short of breath that they can't even really talk without their oxygen levels dropping. We encourage them to text more at that point, so they're not using their energy to talk. But, you know, some of these patients are there for quite a long time waiting for their oxygen levels to get better. And they're by themselves in a room with just no contact with their family or friends, only with the hospital staff. So it does get very hard on these patients dealing with depression and anxiety and what's going to happen to them. And we try to be as supportive as possible. But of course, it's nothing like being with one of your loved ones.
No, of course not. I would imagine that would be extremely difficult. And from talking with your patients, how are most of them contracting the virus?
I always ask my patients, you know, how do they think they got this? Some of them say they got it from their family members that they have lived with, who may have contracted from other friends or family or from work. Some patients say they got it from work. And some people just don't know. But I'd say most commonly it's from, you know, their family or friends that they've been in contact with.
And what are you seeing in terms of the long-term impact of COVID on the lungs? Are patients returning with symptoms related to lung damage?
You know, we've had some patients that have, you know, been admitted initially for a few days and have been doing well, not requiring too much oxygen and can go home. And then they come back like a week or 10 days later requiring increased amounts of oxygen. Or they sometimes have to end up on the ventilator or they're on what we call high flow, which is a high amount of oxygen delivered through the nose, or on BiPAP, which is another type of non-invasive ventilation. And then they're again stuck in the hospital for weeks. There have been a lot of reports of patients that are at home and they still are requiring oxygen at home for months, just waiting for the lungs to heal. And they are short of breath for that long too.
Is there a patient who really stands out for you, either in terms of their resiliency or how they've, you know, managed to stay in the hospital for weeks and maybe they've come out of it, or just someone you connected with?
You know, I have, we've had a few young patients, especially in their 20s or early 30s. And those patients really stand out to me. Mainly because they're young, and I think that it's especially scary for them to be in the hospital by themselves and requiring high amounts of oxygen. Nobody thinks in their 20s are going to get this horrible pneumonia and have to be on so much oxygen when they were a totally normal person before and able to do anything that they wanted. I've had a few younger patients that unfortunately, you know, were diagnosed with new diabetes once they came to the hospital. And so that was probably one of their underlying conditions that made them have a more severe form of COVID, and that where they were requiring high amounts of oxygen for about a week to 10 days. Those patients really stood out to me. Fortunately, they all did very well and were able to go home. But I think it was really traumatic for them, you know, because in your 20s, you're young and active and you don't really feel like you ever need to go to the doctor because you're doing fine.
And not only for young people, but for many Californians, coronavirus numbers are kind of like metrics on a screen. But what does it mean for Kern County that cases are increasing at such a rapid rate? You know, right now the county has a total of about, or has had a total of about 17,000 cases. Tell me what that looks like to you, you know, from your perspective.
Well, we have had a big surge in cases over the last couple weeks, and it is pretty scary to see such high numbers in our county. And unfortunately, our numbers are becoming higher in the hospital of how many patients are needing to be hospitalized. I'm hoping that, you know, these numbers will start decreasing. And I think one way we can do that, which I've seen, I'm glad it's mandated now that we all wear masks, because that significantly decreases the transmission of the virus. But, you know, everyone needs to just abide by the orders of wearing a mask and avoiding large gatherings and keeping your distance. And hopefully that will improve our numbers here in Kern County.
And as we know, many of the deaths in the state are connected with nursing homes, as much as 40%. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing a lot of nursing home residents?
We were in the beginning. So initially in March and April, we were seeing a lot of nursing home patients. But recently, we haven't been seeing as many. It's more, you know, younger patients in their 50s or 60s. And we haven't seen too many nursing home patients. I think they really got some good precautions in place now. And so we haven't seen too many patients come in from nursing home recently.
One more question. What's the difference between caring for a patient in the ICU versus another floor on the hospital?
So the patients in the ICU are the sickest patients in the hospital. Those are the patients that are either on the ventilator or are requiring high amounts of oxygen that, you know, they may end up being on the ventilator. They're at a high chance of ending up on the ventilator. The patients on the floor, they are usually requiring oxygen and higher amounts of oxygen than what can be delivered at home, but they're otherwise pretty stable in terms of their heart rate, their blood pressure, and their oxygen requirements are not as high as what we, you know, that they're teetering on and needing to be on the ventilator. So, you know, those patients are usually a little bit less sick, but they still get watched pretty closely. They're still on the monitor all the time. It's just a matter of kind of where they are and how are they looking and how are they breathing and how much oxygen they're requiring.
So care for any COVID patient in the hospital is still pretty intense.
Yeah, it's intense for the patient and the staff. I mean, we still use the same protective equipment wherever the patient is in the hospital. And it's just a matter of watching them carefully and, you know, making sure that they get better and they're getting all their needs attended to. A lot of these patients, they also lose their appetite. They don't, you know, they don't feel good. They're not hungry. And, you know, some of them need fluids or any other type of nutrition. So, you know, they need help using the bathroom because they get so short of breath just moving around trying to use the restroom. So they do need a lot of care.
Wow. Well, Dr. Mehta, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and me, Laura Satsui. Host Kathleen Schock will be back next week. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.